You've probably heard about speed dating. You meet very briefly, check the other person out, see if you have any chemistry, and move on. That same model is now being applied to small businesses trying to make quick connections with potential buyers of their products. From Chicago Public Radio, Adrian Hill has the story.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. All right, I absolutely shouldn't be singing on the radio, but here at a business matchmaking event just outside of Chicago, it's hard not to think of the song. It's basically speed dating for businesses. This is the sound of just about 70 business meetings going on all at once. Small business owners have 15 minutes to make their case to private and public sector buyers.
I want to sell you fuel, lubricants, oils, greases, hydraulic fluids.
That's Michael Nicholas. He owns NIMS Services, Inc., a small business in Washington, D.C. I watch as he chats up a representative from the U.S. General Services Administration in a large ballroom at this convention center. There'll be about 1,000 of these meetings at this event. At the end of each, there's a signal that means it's time to move on. His next meeting is with a private company. He navigates using the numbers posted on the tables, and organizers pair the buyers and sellers. Nicholas is a bit of a pro here. He says he's been to more than a dozen such events.
You have to go in directly knowing your customer, what they generally will be looking for as products and services, and attack it hard for the first 15 minutes.
Nicholas says his company will generate about $10 million in revenue this year. 80% he estimates he's won through connections he's made at these events. But Dan Sturdivant, who's here as a buyer with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, says a small business won't get work just by showing up.
Anybody that comes here looking for a contract is making a grave mistake.
He says, like speed dating, this first meeting is only the beginning of a possible relationship. After that, you have to get to know each other. Actually getting the contract, that's commitment, much like getting a ring.
It is a marriage. It is a marriage. You are now in bed with this agency doing what they ask you to do, and you do it, and they're doing what you ask them to do for the next 5 years. And if you're lucky enough to continue the relationship, the contract is renewed over and over again.
It's a good time to be a small business owner looking for that sort of partnership, especially with the federal government. The Small Business Administration says the stimulus package will likely result in tens of billions of additional dollars in contracts available to small businesses. Overall, the federal government aims to hand out nearly a quarter of its contracts to small business owners.
The overwhelming majority would be totally intimidated and find ridiculous the concept of, I think I'll go to Washington, and I'll knock on the door at Homeland Security, find out if they want to buy office supplies from me.
That's Chuck Ashman, who heads up business matchmaking. He runs it as a nonprofit. The event is free for buyers and for sellers. Corporate sponsors pay to underwrite these events. And this group holds about four of them around the country every year. Ashman says demand is at an all-time high. There's lots of money out there right now, and even more businesses looking for a second date. For NPR News, I'm Adrienne Hill in Chicago.
Like hotels and their housekeepers, publishers are hurting. But this week brought some real excitement to the publishing industry. It began with the release on Monday of the new Ted Kennedy memoir, True Compass. It ends today with Oprah's announcing her new book club pick. In between, Dan Brown's new book, The Lost Symbol, hit the bookstores. NPR's Lynn Neary has more.
A trifecta was the way people in the business described it, and on Tuesday, Barnes & Noble announced that The Lost Symbol broke all records for one-day sales of adult fiction. Barnes & Noble Vice President for Marketing, Patricia Bostelman, says it was a marked contrast to the same time last year.
Well, I think this September compared to last September is euphoric. I think we have seen the worst of it. We are seeing a buoyancy come back in our business and in a general optimism in people who are shopping.
But for Jonathan Carr, publisher and editor-in-chief of 12, the early success of Ted Kennedy's True Compass was bittersweet, coming as it did just weeks after the death of Senator Kennedy.
It's been an incredibly emotional experience to publish this book.
Early on, Carr made a decision to delay the e-book publication of True Compass. He's holding fast to that decision, even though Amazon has reported that its Kindle version of the book is outselling the hardback.
This book has over 100 photos in it, many of them in color. It has his original artwork. And when we signed up the book, the Kindle didn't even exist, and our business plan was based on selling a certain number of hardcovers and then a certain number of paperbacks. And we would eventually like to sell a lot of ebooks, but we're going to stick to our business plan.
And pretty much everyone agrees bringing more customers into bookstores is crucial. That's how a book like The Lost Symbol helps boost the sales of all books. Dan Halpern is president and publisher of Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins.
When people are in the stores buying that book, the assumption is that they will buy other books. If they're not in the bookstores, they're not going to buy any books. So anything that gets people in large numbers into the bookstores is a good thing.
At this time last year, Halpern got the call all publishers dream of these days. Oprah Winfrey picked one of his author's books, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, for her book club.
We probably had sold about 300,000 at that point. So the book was doing incredibly well. I mean, it was on the bestseller list. And she said, my goal is to sell a million copies. And she did.
And that's why today the book business is waiting expectantly to hear who Oprah will pick this year. There's already been a lot of speculation in the media. And Barnes & Noble's Patricia Bostelman says the bookstore chain has boxes of books waiting to go on the shelves as soon as the title is officially made public.
Our booksellers know exactly what to do. They have the cartons in the back room of the store. We have a very, very tight procedure for not opening them until the moment it is allowed to do so, not unlike how we had to handle The Lost Symbol. And then they, you know, place the books on display and wait for the customers to race in.
And yes, Bostelman says, they do race in almost immediately. And as long as some of them stay to browse and buy some more, the publishing industry will be happy. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. On Wall Street, there's the question, is it too big to fail? And increasingly these days, another question, how much is too much? The Federal Reserve is looking at how banks compensate their employees. It's concerned that many still use bonuses and other incentives in ways that create too much risk. The Fed is working on guidelines that would, for the first time, put it in the position of ruling on pay packages at the thousands of banks it regulates. And NPR's John Idstey joins us to talk about the Fed initiative. John, first of all, does the Fed really have this authority to tell private companies, here's what you can pay your employees?
Well, the Fed says its authority to do this comes from its responsibility to ensure the safety and soundness of the financial firms it regulates. And there's pretty broad agreement that faulty compensation practices encouraged too much risk-taking and contributed to the financial crisis and to the collapse of lots of financial companies. So the Fed believes it has the responsibility to be involved in compensation policies.
And how would the Fed try to make sure that employees aren't encouraged to take too much risk to inflate their compensation?
Well, the Fed hasn't yet issued its guidelines, and it isn't talking publicly about exactly what it will propose. But a source familiar with the Fed's thinking told NPR that the Fed is not going to set pay caps or develop a pay schedule. What it will do is issue a set of principles that it expects the financial companies it regulates to follow. That will happen within a few weeks. There will be a comment period, and the Fed hopes the policy will be in place by the end of the year.
Okay, well, translate that a bit. Principles for the banks to follow. What would that be?
Well, one possibility is to make sure bonuses are adjusted for the amount of risk taking. You want to make sure employees don't get a bigger and bigger bonus for taking more and more risk. Another principle might be to defer bonuses so you have a longer evaluation period. So instead of rewarding a loan officer for the number of mortgages written each month, you base the bonus on how well the mortgages perform over several years.
And we're not talking here about just high-level executives, John. This could apply all the way down to employees deep into a bank loan department.
That's absolutely right. Any employee who is in a position to put the institution at a significant risk would be subject to these principles.
And how many people would we be talking to? How would the Fed go about enforcing this?
Well, tens of thousands of people. It'll be a big job. What I'm told is that the Fed will issue the guidelines, and then banks will develop their own compensation plans based on these principles. The Fed will then focus on the plans of the two dozen biggest financial institutions, the ones that could pose the greatest danger to the financial system. If the Fed sees something it doesn't like, the bank will have to make changes. The pay plans at the thousands of other smaller banks the Fed regulates would be reviewed during their periodic examination by regulators.
And I'm sure banks are thrilled to think about more regulation coming from the Fed.
They're never excited about more regulation. But when I talked to Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable, an industry group today, he acknowledged that the Fed has the authority to do this. But then he added this.
Obviously, we're worried that the rules could be too draconian and have a blanket or a stifling effect on the company and reduce its ability to generate revenue, which would ultimately weaken the institution and make it less safe and sound.
Now, the Fed is, of course, not the only institution addressing this issue. The U.S. government has already set limits on compensation at firms that got aid during the crisis. A House committee has passed a bill also aimed at risky pay packages. And the Europeans want to take action on the subject at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh next week. So it remains a hot topic.
Okay. NPR's John Idsty. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. The next time you step into a shower, beware. Beware not of Norman Bates, but of a different kind of danger. According to a new study, your shower head may be harboring a film of potentially dangerous microbes. Scientists from the University of Colorado Boulder swabbed the insides of 45 shower heads, including the teeming metropolis that is New York and the Rocky Mountain High of Denver. And what they found has a big yuck factor, because growing inside some of the shower heads were films of bacteria, a petri dish of organisms, including a potentially harmful relative of the bug that causes tuberculosis. Joining me now to talk more about it is Norman Pace, a professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Pace.
Delighted. Thank you.
You don't have to be named Norman, I don't think, to be in a shower anymore.
Good idea.
Good idea. Give us an idea. You look for bacteria growing in the shower heads. Tell us what you found.
Well, this is part of a much larger project to study the microbiology of the indoor environment. Mm-hmm. We don't think much about it, but as we humans move around our daily activities, that we're actually moving through a suspension of bacteria. And we know little about that, and the goal of this particular study, supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, is to understand the microbiology of the indoor environment.
Mm-hmm. And did you find any potentially harmful ones there?
Well, the showerhead story was, again, a small part of a much larger story, and in this particular case, we were trying to focus on areas where we knew that potential pathogens occur, which could occur in such a way as to increase exposure to otherwise organisms that you might not be exposed to.
Mm-hmm. And you found
And the specific organism that we encountered at high levels in many shower heads was of concern. It's an organism by the name of Mycobacterium avium. It's one of a collection of closely related organisms that, among other things, cause serious pulmonary disease.
Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean, though, when I take a shower, I'm going to get some lung disease.
Well, not necessarily. So there are two issues. One, there's the microorganisms that accumulate in the shower head, and the other issue is the microorganisms that come in with the municipal waters. And so what we found is that the organisms that form biofilms inside shower heads are a subset of the organisms that are fed in through the municipal waters, but particularly whereas Mycobacterium avium occurs at, say 0.1 to 1% of total bacteria in the municipal waters that you would detect. In the case of shower heads, they could be up to 70 or 80% of what's there, namely a 100-fold enrichment of the background microbiology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the large issue, however, is this microbiology is always around. These organisms are called opportunistic pathogens in the sense that they're always around but yet can infect you. And the real issue with showers is the mode in which the organisms are delivered. And there is the issue, because showers generate aerosols. Many aerosol particles are very small, 20 micrometers or less in diameter, and they can penetrate the deep airways, carrying along any bacteria that happen to be there for the ride, i.e. those that wash out of shower heads or just happen to come out through the municipal water.
Mm-hmm. And so the chlorine in your water system doesn't kill these bacteria.
Well, even a little bit worse, the chlorine in the water system actually selects for mycobacteria because they tend to be fairly resistant to chlorine.
Mm-hmm.
And so whereas the chlorine knocks off many of the organisms, the Mycobacterium avium, it perhaps slows down, but certainly doesn't restrict development.
So whereas these bacteria may be living all around us in the soil and other places and may not be harmful to us, what I'm hearing you say is that when they're made into an aerosol and they're sprayed and we inhale it deeply into our lungs, That's where the problem may result.
That's the problem, and that's the specific problem. The organisms are always there. They're present in greater or lesser concentrations, but the issue is one of, are they delivered to a place where disease can result? And the shower aerosols are a good shot for that.
So if you come down with a cough, let's say, and you go to your doctor, and he looks at you and he says, well, it may be TB or something, and I'll do tests for all those things, and I don't find anything, and you say, but I'm still coughing, he or she may not be testing for the right thing.
That's correct. Mycobacterium avium disease, pulmonary disease, is a, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of diagnostics in this country. The issue is that Mycobacterium avium pulmonary disease is not a communicable disease. You don't catch it from human to human. You catch it from exposure to the environment. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, it's not considered a communicable disease by the CDC, the Communicable Diseases Center. And so there's not even records, national records, on the occurrence of Mycobacterium avium. But there's general agreement that it far outweighs Mycobacterium tuberculosis than in this country at this time.
And it's far less deadly?
Well,
we don't know.
We don't. I think it just chews away at your lungs, much like tuberculosis does.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a disease also which probably accumulates over the course of years before you ever seek therapy.
So if you really wanted to be proactive, you should be speaking to your doctor about testing for that.
Yes, if there is concern. And what means concern? Well, what that means is a low-grade cough that persists for months. You feel lousy, weak, perhaps breathing difficulties, particularly when exerting. Yes, that's a good reason to finger the possibility of Mycobacterium avium pulmonary disease.
Now,
it's very underdiagnosed.
It's very interesting. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Is there anything we can do to disinfect our shower heads?
Well, you can disinfect your shower head, and you might kill everything in there for a while or momentarily. But the fact is that inocula are continuously being loaded in from the municipal water coming into the shower head. And it's a dark, moist place, and that's a nice place for the organisms to grow. And it turns out that Mycobacterium avium, the properties of that organism, are particularly disposed to formation of very tough biofilms.
Mm-hmm. There are so many different kinds of shower heads. There are metal ones, plastic ones. Are any of them better at resisting the bacteria?
Well, we have no hard information on that. We have only anecdotal information. And what that means is that our approach to sampling the shower heads was to take the shower head off and swab it out. And if you have a plastic shower head, it oftentimes will look a lot worse than a metal shower head in terms of the biofilm load. And also, we tend to get a lot more DNA out of plastic shower heads than we do out of metal shower heads. Mm-hmm. So our hip shot conclusion at this stage of the game is that use of metal shower heads is probably a very good thing to do compared to plastic shower heads. And I would even extend that into household piping. A lot of metal piping is being replaced with plastic these days, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing because the plastics will load up more readily than metals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all plastics load up more, but the kinds of plastics that are used for bathroom facilities, they do.
Mm-hmm. We have a tweet from Ollie Eckerson that came in. It says, what about municipal water versus well water versus rainwater, different kinds of water?
Yeah. Well, we looked at municipal water supplied shower heads and four only, well water supplied shower heads. And we saw no Mycobacterium avium in well water supplied shower heads. We could detect Mycobacterium in more than 80% of shower heads from fed by municipal waters.
Wow. Let me see if I can get a quick call in here. David in Denver. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a person living with HIV infection, and I've been living with HIV for almost 28 years at this point from blood transfusions in 1981. And in the HIV/AIDS community, we're familiar with Mycobacterium avium complex, which generally speaking doesn't become a problem for human immunology until one is below 100 T4 cells. They're called helper cells. And at that point, we begin to consider in HIV clinical treatment the taking of Mycobacterium avium complex prophylaxis, specifically drugs like azithromycin, an antibiotic. And so I'm wondering to what degree for persons with normal immunology, which clearly I'm not one of those persons, and nor would persons who are undergoing cancer chemotherapy, but for persons of normal immunology, to what extent is the emergence of Mycobacterium avium in showerheads, for example, a widespread problem?
Well, the one problem is that whether taking any particular shower is problematic, you never know, of course. Mycobacterium avium, or you use the term Mycobacterium avium complex, which is a good one to use because there's several organisms that fall into that particular bailiwick. That is, they're all very closely related organisms. Other examples of these organisms would be, beyond Mycobacterium avium, would be Mycobacterium intracellulari, for example, in very close relatives of one another. Mm. So for a person with a normal immune response, I would say that probably there's no particular threat. One problem that arises, however, is that Mycobacterium avium disease, or MAC disease, Mycobacterium avium complex disease, is insidious. It can persist at low grade for many, many years, and then, and only then, become a problem. And again, the disease may be very well developed before the symptoms are manifest, that can be a problem. I think in the case of individuals who are of normal constitution and not elderly or not drug addicted or not HIV infected, or many cases of immune compromise that one can cite, I think that if one is not particularly compromised, there's not a particular problem. Mm-hmm. And if, however, there is compromise, which you may not even be aware of at any given time, then there's an issue.
So be aware of the possibility of it.
I think be aware of the possibility. And you know what I think that the real issue is the aerosols that are generated by the shower. If one is concerned, the straightforward thing to do is to take a bath instead of a shower, because a bath doesn't have the aerosol-generating qualities that the shower has.
So you shouldn't worry about swimming pools either, then.
Well, that's another issue. That's another study that we have underway of both therapeutic and public swimming pools and Mycobacterium avium, MAC, is an issue in those particular settings.
We'll have you back to talk about that. Is that something undergoing now?
It's underway right now. Correct. Mm-hmm.
So if you think you're compromised and you're worried about it, though, take a bath.
Take a bath or stop using a shower head and just hook a straight hose up to your shower. Instead of the shower head, just plug a hose onto the water outlet that would normally feed into the shower head and take a hose bath instead of a shower bath.
All right. Well, we'll have you back when your swimming pool study
is finished.
Sounds quite interesting, Dr. Pace. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Norman Pace, professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Colorado.